of our faith. So we've been looking at this book of Job from the perspective of why these difficulties, why adversities come into the life of God's people. There are five different perspectives, remember, that the book sets forth as explaining why suffering, adversity comes into the lives of God's people. We started off with the view of the narrator in the first two chapters. We learned there that suffering was a spiritual battle, a spiritual warfare. Job was suffering because he was righteous, not because he was a sinner, because indeed he was a man that feared God, a man that turned from evil, and there was that spiritual confrontation that was taking place, and Job became the battleground of that confrontation. We come then to look at the friends of Job, his comforters, and in their theology, they understand that suffering is the result of sin. If you sin, you will suffer. And I emphasize that what Job's friends are saying is very true. And we multiply other references in Scripture that teach the same theology as Job's friends. They were not unorthodox. They were not ungodly men. They were men that had received word from the Lord. Remember Eliphaz's comment that he had that vision of the night as God revealed these truths to him. Bildad looked at all of the past traditions and the past history of God's dealings with men. God had revealed these truths. And indeed it is true that God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that he will also reap. And Job's friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, have that theology. That if you suffer, you must have sinned. Now, we know that they were wrong in regard to Job. But nonetheless, while what they said did not apply to Job in this instance, as we remind ourselves over and again, it very well may apply to us. And it needs to be that which we consider. Search our hearts as the Lord gives grace as we find ourselves going through adversity. Is there something that the Lord is chastening us for? We don't beat ourselves up. And if our conscience is clear, if our hearts are clear and cleansed by the blood of Christ, we don't sit around making up sins in order to confess. And this, I think, is what happens over and over again. The theology of Job's friend permeates Christianity today. And the idea is that if something is going wrong, there must be the chastening hand of God. And you begin to make up sins to confess, and you keep going back into that stockpile of past sins that you've already confessed, have already been put under the blood, and you keep bringing those up. God has forgotten those. And this is the confidence that Job had. Job did not maintain his sinlessness. Job did not maintain that he was without fault. He confessed his fault. But he knew that those sins had been confessed. He was a man that engaged in the sacrifice, and he used the means that God had defined and ordained to deal with those sins. And he knew that before God, his conscience was clear in regard to those sins, that he would not bring them back up. And he knew God was not bringing them back up. And that's why he knew that the arguments of his friends were wrong in his behalf. He had confidence in the blood that had cleansed from sin. And we must have that same confidence as well. These past weeks, we've been looking specifically at the third perspective of suffering in this book, and that comes from Job himself. And we summarize Job's perspective as this suffering being an inexplicable problem. Job did not understand what was taking place. He knew that he was in his heart right with God. He knew that his sins had been confessed. But it did not make any sense to him why this adversity, why this physical suffering was going on. And as it continued, Job then began to question. He questioned the meaning of life. Why have I been born? Why did I not die as soon as I came into this world? Why was I even conceived? And the meaning of life was escaping Job as he went through these sufferings. He began to misunderstand many times what God was doing. He knew. And again, here's the tension. The more we believe that God is the ruler upon his throne, the more we believe that God is the providential controller of all that which takes place, the greater the tension will be within our heart when we don't understand what God is doing. And Job knew it. And so he began to wonder and question in his moments of faithlessness, whether God was caring about any more. He thought that God was disinterested. He felt that God was now distant from him. And we know that Job was wrong. And Job was going through what he experienced because God was vitally interested in him. And Job had a testimony, a reputation in heaven of being the man he was. And all of this was happening because of God's vital concern and God's vital interest in Job. But as we understand our own circumstances, it's much easier to determine what's going on by what we see rather than that faith in what we cannot see. And Job was going through that kind of turmoil as well. And so we see in Job those expressions of faithlessness as he lost sight of God. Not the relationship that he had with God. Now we need to make that very clear. Job never did what Satan said he would do. Job never reneged upon the relationship that he had with God. He never went back on that relationship. He never stopped believing the gospel as Satan was trying to make him do. But while he never forsook his faith, there were times when faith was not so strong. And when he became overwhelmed with the circumstances and allowed the doubts and the fears and the suffering to overwhelm him. And this is what we're going to see, and what we have been seeing in Job, that as he became involved with the circumstances, as he allowed the circumstances to overwhelm him, we have those statements of doubt, of fear, of misunderstanding what God was doing. But yet, even in the midst of that, we have those great instances when Job is able, by the grace of God, to look beyond his adversity, to look beyond the scabs and the sores that were festering upon his body, to see the goodness of God and the reality of God, and that God was his only hope, regardless of what circumstances appear to be. Times of faithlessness, but yet even in the midst of his trouble, expressions of great faith. Now, this is what we want to do today as we we're suggesting at the close of our discussion last week. Today we want to look at some of those great expressions of faith that Job makes. Not just at the end of his affair, but great expressions and statements of faith that he manifested, that he declared in the midst of the trouble, in the midst of the suffering, in the midst of difficulty, where he had, I say, by the grace of God, ability by faith to look beyond what appeared to the reality of God's interest, to the reality of God's goodness, to the reality of God's will. And he knew that if there was to be vindication, it was going to come from God. Job was being accused not only by the devil, but now by his friends. And he realized that if his testimony and if his life was to be vindicated, he was not going to be vindicated by his arguments. His friends ignored everything that he said. And this became a very senseless kind of debate between Job's friends and himself. Job's friends ignored everything Job said, and Job ignored everything the friends said. And they kept arguing one against the other, and it was getting no place. If there was to be vindication, it had to come from God. And so Job had his desire to present his case, to present the evidence before the Lord himself. Now, there were times in expressing this desire when he thought that God had become too distant, that God would not bend his ear and make himself known to Job to hear his case. But yet, even in those statements of doubt, Job knew that the ultimate vindication had to come from the Lord. And we're going to see that this hope of vindication ultimately expresses the same theology that we have in the New Testament. That even if in this life vindication does not come, I know that vindication ultimately will come. If it has to be after death, so be it. But I know, Job says, that my God will vindicate me. And we're going to see the same theology in Job that we see in the Apostle Paul or in the New Testament. That if we suffer with Christ, we are going to reign. Now, that vindication may not come in this life. It may not come in this life. But the vindication is ultimately going to come. And God will not forsake his people. And we're going to see then in this book some of the most expressed statements that we have anywhere in God's Word concerning life after death, concerning the hope of immortality, concerning the resurrection. I say that's remarkable. We often hear those that talk about the scheme of progressive revelation, and I certainly would argue in that regard, that truth is progressively revealed. And we've talked about that before. But while that's the case, I want us to understand that some of the most advanced and complete statements we have in the Word of God concerning the resurrection and the hope of a believer in that resurrection comes from the lips of suffering Job. And here we have a man that was living most likely before Abraham. Very advanced theology and a very advanced hope. And his hope is the same hope that we have. The vindication is going to come. It may not come in life, but it's going to come. And so he once again expresses his ultimate confidence in the Lord. Now let's take a look. All I'm going to do is survey some of these classic passages that give expressions of Job's hope in the Lord, regardless of what things appear to be. Let's take a look at chapter 13. We have here one of the perhaps more famous of the verses of Job. Job begins this chapter by once again rejecting the words of his friends. He says, notice how he begins, the chapter, "Lo, my eye hath seen all this, my ear hath heard and understood. What ye know, the same thing do I know also." I'm not inferior to you. Job has been listening to the theology of his friends. He said, yes, I understand that. I agree with, in principle, what you're saying. Not disputing what you're saying, but I am disputing the application that you are giving this to me. It's true, yes, that God chastens because of sin, but that's not what's taking place in my life. And so he goes through these opening verses, rejecting once again the accusations that his friends have been making to him. And he expresses then his desire, once again, to make his case known before the Lord. I want to meet the Lord. And I want to speak and give my case directly to the Lord, because there is the only place that there will be vindication. Now, I don't know how things are going to turn out. I don't know perhaps how he will respond to me. I can use that expression. But nonetheless, the Lord is the only hope. Now this leads into that great statement in verse 15. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him, but I will maintain my own ways before him. But that is there seems to be a very strong adversative. I think we could perhaps translate that not as an adversative conjunction, but as an asseverative. What we call an asseverative. Surely, surely I will maintain. Indeed, I will maintain my own ways before him. I'm not going to maintain my cause before you people. You people don't listen to anything I say. And even if you did agree with me, ultimately, what difference would that make? It has to be before God that I maintain my thoughts, that I express my needs, or present my case to him. And though he slay me, it may be that this will ultimately come to my death. So be it. But nonetheless, irrespective of what he does to me, I will trust in him. I will put my confidence, I will put my hope, and I will put my reliance and my dependence upon him. It's one of the classic words in the Old Testament for faith. Resting upon, putting confidence in. It is God that must be my confidence. And because I am trusting in the Lord, because he is the foundation of my security and my confidence and my hope, then no matter what he does, it'll be right. But I surely then, indeed I must prove myself, maintain my own ways before him. Now, I'm not going to get into all of the problems here of grammar. This is in some ways a difficult verse. The language of Job is perhaps some of the most difficult Hebrew in the entire Old Testament. I always, some of my advanced students, right here, that's not here, start putting a little copy. I always make assignments in Job that brings them back down to reality. since pops up in the grammar of the book of Joel, and this is one of those verses that traditionally has been difficult. There are some other versions. I think of I think it's the RSV that translates this verse in a way that it is completely opposite of what the text says here. The Revised Version translates that, he will kill him. I have no hope. And they play around with some of the words there and completely reverse the sense of what is taking place. Now, I'm not going to go into all the technicalities of the proper grammar, but I will say that what the Authorized Version is doing indeed is expressing the best approach to that. He may sleep. But rather than saying, I have no hope, he says, this is the only hope I have. Now, notice what he says in verse 16. I think the statement of verse 16 completely destroys the rendering of some of these other versions. He also shall be my salvation. Now, that seems to be a strange statement Joel would make if he then says in the preceding verse, I've got no hope. Here it is confessed, God is my deliverance. God is my salvation. And hypocrites shall not come before him. Here is Job's confidence then again in his own veracity of faith, in the legitimacy of his faith. I'm not a hypocrite. And I know that because I, in my heart, am right with God, that he is my deliverance. Great expression. Now, when Job says this, he is covered with sores. He is covered with those stinking scabs and putrefying sores that has caused his statements of fear in other times. But here he is. He's able now to look beyond himself to see the foundation and the firmness and the solidity of the God who is the source and the basis of his confidence. Now there's the secret for us. There's the secret for us. Why did the Job vacillate? Why do we see these ups and downs in Job's experience? When he looks at himself, there's that. When he looks beyond himself to the reality of God, there's that. It's the same person. When we become overwhelmed with what we see, we begin to know that tension in our hearts between the goodness of God and all the troubles that we have in life. And don't think that there's not any troubles. I don't know who I'm looking at here. I don't know all your personal life. It goes on with you day by day. But I know that every one of you here has your troubles. And if I didn't know you, the book here, look what Job says in chapter 14. Man that is born of woman is few of days and full of trouble. Now I'm confident that every one of you here fits that category. Every one of you is born of woman. And you're going to die. You're not going to live very long upon this earth. And the short days that you have are full of trouble. Doesn't take a genius to see. It takes a few days on earth to realize that there is trouble that comes in the life. Part of life. Being saved does not eliminate those adversities and those troubles that come in life. But how do we react to those adversities? How do we respond to those adversities? No matter how saved we are, how long we've been saved, no matter how mature we think we are in the Christian faith, if we allow the circumstances to be that which we see, we are going to have the same problems that Job had. The same statements of despair, discouragement. The fact that you've been saved 40 years is not going to eliminate you from the troubles of life. And the fact that you had victory in the past is not going to mean you've got victory now. You've got to get your eyes, and I've got to get my eyes off the circumstances that breed the adversity or breed the tension to the reality of God whom we can trust regardless. And irrespective of what he does to us, if he slays us, fine. Nonetheless, I will trust him. There's hope there in the vindication that comes from the Lord. Classic statement of his faith. In chapter 14, we have another of these wonderful statements of Job's faith. Now, I made reference a moment ago to some of the great statements that Job makes concerning the resurrection and his hope and ultimate
vindication. Chapter 14 is one of those great chapters, great texts, statements of Job that take us to see his hope of ultimate vindication, even if it comes after, even if it comes after this life. Now, he does this by way of illustration. He makes a comparison. Let's begin reading this text at verse 7. Job 14, verse 7. For there is hope of the tree, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and that the tender branch thereof will not cease, though the root thereof wax old in the earth, and the stock thereof die in the ground. Yet through the scent of water it will bud, and bring forth boughs like a plant. But man dieth and wasteth away. Yea, man giveth up the ghost, and where is he? As the waters fail from the sea, and the flood decayeth and drieth up, so man lieth down and riseth not, till the heavens be known, they shall not awake, nor be raised out of their sleep. Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in the grave, that thou wouldst keep me secret until thy wrath be past, that thou wouldst appoint me a set time, and remember me. If a man die, shall I live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait, till my change come. Thou shalt call, and I will answer. I will have a desire to work, to the work of thy hand. If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait, till my change come. Now he asks a question here. If a man die, will he live again? Now it seems perhaps on the surface of this text that Job again is expressing despair and doubt. He makes reference to a tree. Here's a tree. It's an insensate tree, and if you cut this thing down, there's hope of that tree that it will somehow rise again. Have this experience. You've seen this. You cut a tree down, nothing left there but the stump of that tree. And from every appearance, it seems as though that tree is dead and gone. But how many times have you seen then coming from that stump a new shoot, a new shoot of life? A little twig that comes, a little shoot from green and light that appears to be dead, but there's the sign of life. It sprouts again. It sprouts again. Tender branch. And there's life in that tree, even though it appears at first to be completely without hope. Now that's what we see in the tree. Through all seasons. But a man dies. First thing, a man dies and he wastes away. A man dies. And the body of that man is put in the grave and it rots. And it rots away. The flesh corrupts. And it appears, does it not? You open up a grave. I put that in there. You open up a grave and you look in there and you've got a rotten mess. Or if it's been a long time, you open up and you've got nothing. You won't. What kind of hope of life is that? And from the outward appearance, man dies and he wastes away, his flesh corrupts, and it appears that there is no hope. Gone. Gone forever. What appears to be. But what are we learning in this book? That appearance and reality are not the same thing. What appears to be and what really is are two different things. Particularly in the spiritual realm. So Job here asks the question. If a man dies, what would it be? Now, there are some churches that take that question and say, here's Job's expression of faithlessness, of Job's despair. They're answering that question, no, a man will not live again. But that question has two answers. You don't have to answer that question, no. And the very fact that Job asked that question, in the light of the comparison that he's just given of a body that is gone and corrupted and defiled, the very fact that he now asks this question, I say, is an expression of despair. There's something that's gone, it's dead, it's corrupt. Will this thing live again? Now look what he says. Look what he says. All the days of my appointed time Well, I will. Till my change come. Now, we can't see it perhaps too clearly in English, and you'll take my word for it. But I've never lied to you consciously before. Look at verse 7. What happened to this tree?
There is hope for a tree if it be cut down, that it will sprout again. New life coming to this tree that appears to be dead. Verse 14 now. The man dies and live again. All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. And the word change that he uses in verse 14 is from the same root as that word sprout in verse 7. Same. The comparison that he's making here cannot go unnoticed. So what does he say? You look at the tree and it seems to be without hope, but it sprouts again. You look at this body of man that is corrupt and defiled and destroyed by death, but it is going to, can I use the same word, it is going to sprout again. The body is going to sprout again. And just as that tree evidences the new life, so will man, even though he be dead. Even though he is in the grave, the grave here is not the end of things. Job is saying here, I may very well die out of this field. And as we've seen before, death was not all that unattractive to Job in this great suffering that he was going through. I very well may die in this field, but I know that even if I die, that this is not the end of things. Oh, there's appointed time. There is an appointed time, a set time in which I will have to wait. But I know that I will sprout again. I know that there is going to be a new life and there is going to be a vindication. The imagery here, say, is an illustration that he uses. But the language in the imagery cannot go unnoticed. There's hope that he has in a life that is to come. This life of suffering, this life of ill, this life of adversity. It's not the end of it. It's not the end of this. The only thing it was going to be the end of was his suffering. The only thing it would be the end of would be his suffering. It was not the end of his life. Oh, there was an appointed time. He says, let me be in the grave here. Set time may come and you will remember. We've talked about this concept of remembering before. Not that God has forgotten, that God just lets things slip his mind. Here's that term of will, of divine will. That time when God has set to now put his mind actively upon whatever the object. And here's Job's confidence. The time will come when God in his will set his mind upon Job for vindication. There is an appointed time of this vindication here. Great expression there of his hope of something better to come. Maybe not in this life, but certainly in the life to come. Look at chapter 16. Look at chapter 16. Another great statement. Of his life. Also now, behold, my witness is in heaven. My record is on high. Oh, my friend, tears store me, but my eyes pour out my tears unto God, that one might plead for a man for God. As a man pleadeth for his name. Now you go back to chapter 3, or chapter 9, right? Let's put this in the context of chapter 9. There is on his fits of despair. Job realized that if he was to have a hearing with God, there would have to be an arbiter. There would have to be a mediator to plead for it. And in chapter 9, we have one of his expressions of despair. Look at verse 32. Speaking of God, he's not a man that I am, that I can answer. And that we should come together in judgment. Neither is there any daysman betwixt us that might lay his hand upon us and take his rod away from his son.
There's no umpire rules.
Here, he sees God to be so distant. He sees God at this point to be so disinterested that could there be anyone that could bring us together?
Sees the need of mediation there. But he feels that God is so far away. God is so distant that nobody can bring them together. But now in chapter 6, we see a different statement.
That witness and that arbiter and that umpire that Job knew was necessary.
As he came before God, he now knows that he has. Behold, my witness is in heaven. My record's on high. My friends scorn me here.
But I know that I have a witness right now. I have an arbiter right now
in heaven. Here's the confidence that he has. In a present witness. A present arbiter. A present umpire. Mediator. Certainly has Christological significance. I would suggest that Job here. Oh, he may not know that this mediator will one day be called Jesus and he'll live in that. I'm not saying he knows all that. But I'm saying that he has the theology to realize it by divine revelation that he has one in heaven that intercedes for him. That he has that one in heaven to make his case before the Lord. Nobody on earth is going to do it. I've got nobody on earth to do it. But I've got one in heaven. I've got one in heaven. And here, identified as the witness. John calls him a character. But John calls him. Job didn't know Greek, so he didn't call him a character. It's the same person.
The paraclete, that one that we have, that advocate that we have, that John talks about.
The right hand.
If we say we've got an advocate, we've got that witness, we've got that arbiter, we've got that mediator.
The paraclete, the one called alongside. Now we know a lot of theology about it. So did you. So did you. I have the witness.
I've got the mediator that I need
in heaven, and he will please.
Right now he'll please
my case before God. That's good. That's good. The next expression comes in chapter 9. Here's the big one. That's the most famous passage in the entire book. That this witness that he has in heaven, one that is the base of his vindication in heaven, is one day going to come here. And there will be, in this resurrection, ultimate vindication. I want to spend a little time on verses 25 and following. This is the most significant passage of our soul. Difficulties here. You can see in your authorized version that there are several words in verses 25 and 26 particularly that are in italics. You have used your English Bibles enough to realize that when the authorized version puts those words in italics, they are not doing that to emphasize the text. But to suggest that these are words that they are supplied to make sense out of what the statement is saying. So there are some words that are supplied. A very number of those words that are supplied there indicate that it is somewhat then of a difficult task. But it's a great one. Basically, two ways that grammatically you can take the passage, and we'll talk about those. My time is gone today. We'll talk about these next week. Different ways that we can take the passage, but we're going to see that in this statement we have great confidence expressed by God in a vindication that is going to come. That this life is not all there is. Oh, I may die unvindicated.
I may go to my grave with my neighbors and my friends thinking me to be a sinner.
Maybe the way I die. But I know that's not how it's going to end. The day is going to come. Sometime. I don't know when. For I know that my Redeemer liveth. I'll talk about that word Redeemer next week. Wonderful. And that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. I'm not going to interpret the word latter day there. It could be just some eschatological phenomenon, although obviously it is. But what Job is saying here is this simply. That someday, sooner or later, I don't know when, but sooner or later, I know that my Redeemer is going to stand. And the word stand here is a legal term. It's a forensic term. He's going to stand for my vindication upon the earth. And then some problems here in verse 26 with the reading. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall be cold as mine, though my reins be consumed within me. Why may die? But this life is not all there. There is going to be a vindication to come. Now, if you have a marginal reading, you have a marginal reading in your Bible. You'll notice in verse 26, they offer this translation. After I awake, though my body be destroyed, get out of my flesh. So, don't you, if you have time during this incoming week, to look at those. And I'll be talking next time. I don't want to get too technical. But I'll try to explain the difference between those two renderings. And I will ultimately be following what you have in the margin. That's what I'm going to interpret the text. And you'll see it to be powerful. A very profound state of hope in the resurrection of all the divinity. Okay, well, my time is passed on. We're going to have to quit now. Come back next week and we'll look at this most important passage. And I trust the Lord will instruct you and bless you as we consider that. Our little slogans. Jesus is the prayer.